And novelist Stuart Onan's latest novel, West of Sunset, he imagines F. Scott Fitzgerald's final years, which he spent in Hollywood. He's living in an apartment in poor health, struggling with alcoholism, and is increasingly despondent over his declining literary reputation. Stuart Onan is the author of 14 previous novels, including The Odds, Emily, A Prayer for Dying, and Last Night at the Lobster. Thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me back, Joe.
What brought you to the life of F. Scott Fitzgerald, of wanting to explore him, and especially in those declining years?
Just my curiosity, in a way, my ignorance. I knew that he'd been out in Hollywood then and had worked for MGM, but I didn't know much more than that. And the further that I got into finding out about him, the more fascinating it was. I mean, he's living at the Garden of Allah with Dorothy Parker and Humphrey Bogart. He's hanging around with all these legendary characters who are either terribly successful or on the verge of great success. And here he is, broke and penniless and separated from the ones he loves.
And there is that, I guess, perception from others that he is doing better than he actually is because of the great success that he had had.
And he's also great at putting on a front. You know, he's always been, you know, the poor kid from the rich neighborhood, you know, the scholarship boy at the boarding school. So he's an outsider who's learned to sort of mesh or sort of mold in the way that Nick does in Gatsby.
What is it about the facts of what we know about his life that made it so appealing for you as a novelist to take this and run with it in a fictional sense?
Really, it's the time and the place and the sensibility. It's Hollywood during the golden age of the studios. And there you have our great romantic, Scott Fitzgerald, and he's in the middle of it. You know, he's on the MGM lot when they're shooting The Wizard of Oz. He's involved in the script writing of Gone with the Wind. So he's there sort of in the middle of a great, great era. And I thought, you know, what a glamorous, romantic place. And it's not just Fitzgerald in Hollywood. It's Fitzgerald in Hollywood in love.
At the beginning of the novel, you start off in North Carolina. That's where the novel opens. So where are we at that point?
This is kind of rock bottom for him. This is after he's written the essays in The Crack Up, where he sort of admits to the world that everything has gone wrong and he's got nothing now. He's a different man. He's changed. He's broken down. And Zelda is in Highland Hospital there, and her treatments don't seem to be working. And he's in debt to his agent, Harold Ober, over $30,000. And he gets this chance to go out to Hollywood and make some money, pay off his debts, and maybe find some time to write the novel that he owes Max Perkins at Scribner's. And so he takes it.
When he takes it, it basically becomes a good writer who is punching up scripts and kind of getting paid by the word, right?
Well, he's making big bucks for the Depression. I mean, he's getting paid $1,000 a week, which is a quick way to pay off your debts back then. And he's not just punching up scripts. He's writing on some A-list projects. One of the first major films that he's asked to work on is Three Comrades. It's the follow-up to the novel All Quiet on the Western Front by Eric Maria Remarque. So it's a high profile project there. And the script that he writes for that wins its leading lady, Margaret Sullavan, the Best Actress Award.
I guess this is probably, I mean, you are a novelist, so it was never your intention to write this as a biography or as a nonfiction account. But looking at it, what does being a fiction writer allow you? What does it let you do with the facts that you do indeed know?
Well, John Cheever said, "All I want out of reality is possibility." You're looking for those jumping off places that you can go deeper into the character and bring the reader closer to the character. So you want what the biographies don't give you, and that is live scenes between characters that want something from one another. So we get the scenes of Dorothy Parker and Scott, who once had an affair in the 20s, sort of Dorothy thinking, no, maybe we can get back together there. Or we get the scenes in that opening with Zelda and Scott together, those intimate scenes between them in which they discuss basically what is our present and what is our future if we have one there. But I do think there's a nonfiction interest that the reader has, and you don't want to discount that. You want to give them as much good, you know, real information as you can. And if you stretch it too far and take it sort of beyond the bounds of what's, I guess, possible, then the reader will rebel against that, and they'll feel that it's false.
In reading the novel, I have to say, you know, I would read something that, oh, you have him working on the script of Gone with the Wind, and I say, I wonder if that is real or imagined, and then you look it up and know it is indeed real. And I assume you run into that a lot, right? That's something that is surprising. Oh, okay, he's going out and partying with David O. Selznick. Well, okay.
Yeah. And those are the fantastic things in the research that you find. You're like, really? Selznick had a prescription for amphetamines and stayed up all night? Okay. And you work with that and you build it in. And you want to bring the authority, as you would in any kind of novel, even a non-historical novel, so that the reader believes everything is real. Because the reader wants to believe everything is real. That's that suspension of disbelief that we bring to a book when we give ourselves to a book. So as an author, I'm saying, take this as if it's all real. And the reader, in a sense, is saying, I want to take this as if it's all real. Mm. As long as you can sort of, meet and keep to that contract, everything will be fine.
How did he come to work on Gone with the Wind?
Well, he got fired. He got fired from another project that he was working on, and Selznick was just burning through writers. Scott was the ninth writer that Selznick hired, and Eddie Knopf, the producer that hired Scott, thought, he's got two more weeks here at MGM. I'll just loan him out to Selznick, and that'll be that. And that's exactly what happened. After 2 weeks, Selznick let him go, and he was without a job. He was out on the street in the middle of the night with nowhere to go.
As you talk about those moments that you can write about and having the audience believe everything, some of the most beautiful moments in the novel and especially in the writing are the moments between F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda.
And well, thank you.
What was it like to recreate those moments?
It was wonderful because we know that these moments are fraught with emotion, and the mood of those moments is so it can seem quiet, but they're really, really high pitched because they're so important. The people that are closest to us, the people that we want to do the best by, that means so much to us. So every scene with Zelda, as he says early on, he says everything with Zelda was a test because he's always hoping that she's doing better. He's hoping that she can go home at some point. And so he's continually disappointed because by now she's been hospitalized for, I think, 9 years. And she's lost a lot of the person that she was because of all the treatments that have been given her.
And this is a guy, as you mentioned at the beginning, who is now in Hollywood. And that high life that he is known for is mostly over for him at that point because Zelda has been in and out of asylums. And he's lonely and he's broke. And there is really little or no stability in his life at all.
And then he falls in with his old friends from New York, from the Algonquin Roundtable, people like Dorothy Parker, Robert Benchley, S.J. Perelman, Ogden Nash, and living at the Garden of Allah. The partying life has not stopped for them. They're having a big, big time. They're making big money. They're having a wild, Hollywood time. And in the midst of this, he falls in love. And he kind of, falls back in love with the world. He regains that romantic view of the world.
Here is a man who is a romantic and there is not much optimism there, and then that starts to return, right?
Yeah, well, I think Sheila Graham, the gossip columnist who he fell in love with, she was his third great love, and she was a very new kind of woman. Zelda was a new kind of woman for the 1919 or 1920. Sheila Graham is a new kind of woman for the 30s. She's independent, she's tough, she's smart, she's really, in fact, literally a self-made person. She's turned herself into this person, Sheila Graham. That's not even who she really is. So he finds in her an equal and sometimes the person that really needs to sort of kick him in the butt and get him out of his glumness.
As you mentioned, when he returns to the friends from the Algonquin Roundtable, when he's there, your ear for that dialogue of basically writing of what one of those roundtables would have been like. What was that experience like for you as writing and making that dialogue have such spark?
Well, it's a great opportunity. Dorothy Parker, obviously one of the great wits of the last century, and also her husband, Alan Campbell, was supposedly funnier than she was and more cutting. And the relationship's a very weird relationship. Plus, Perelman, who wrote for the Marx Brothers, Benchley, just wildly irreverent. And we forget that Scott himself was a great, great comic writer and also terribly irreverent, and so was Zelda. So that high-spiritedness, that sparkling repartee of screwball comedy, I kind of went back and I looked at the great films from that era. The Thin Man series with William Powell and Myrna Loy, the Fast and Loose series with Rosalind Russell and Robert Montgomery, just beautiful, gorgeous, very funny writing and so playful. And I think that helps leaven some of the heaviness of what has been going on in Fitzgerald's life and also what's going on politically at that time, because we're talking 37 through 40, and this is the end of the Spanish Civil War and the run-up to World War II. So in the Hollywood community, there's some very, very committed writers and actors, and they're in the midst of this. I mean, Dorothy Parker was the president of the Anti-Nazi League. And, of course, Hemingway comes in and does a big fundraiser for Spain. So politics and the fall of Europe, the end of an era, is really on their minds.
And as you just talked about, it is fascinating because once he comes in contact with these people in Hollywood that from the Algonquin Roundtable, and there is that witty repartee, that he almost seems to be playing a part. He is at bottom, and yet he can rise to that occasion.
And that's always been his way. I mean, he is that chameleon figure. He's a fish out of water here. Right, he's the literary writer who's now working for Hollywood, and he's among all these people who have amazing credits. Dorothy Parker and Alan Campbell shared the Oscar for A Star Is Born, the first version of A Star Is Born, and Dorothy Parker is writing lyrics for Billie Holiday. So these are people sort of at the very, very top of their game, and Scott is right up there with them, except that he can't pay his bills.
We are talking to Stuart Onan. His new book is West of Sunset. It is published by Viking. When you look at your work as the 15 novels that you have written, there is really no consistency in subject matter, and I assume that's what you like, that you can pretty much say, okay, I'm now going to go to the late 1930s, early 1940s, and write about this time period.
Well, I always see the connections between the books. And I think in the last five or six books, I've been writing a lot about endurance and what happens after the worst happens. How do you get up off the mat and fight back and regain your life? And I think Last Night at the Lobster, in which the Red Lobster is closed down and we have the managers trying to figure out, what am I going to do with my life? Or The Good Wife, in which Patty, her husband is convicted of murder and is sentenced to 25 years to life. How does she go on? How does she become this other stronger person that needs to go on? And I think Fitzgerald really does this because he's at absolute zero and he says, how can I get my life back? And his answer, like the answer of so many of my characters, is work. I know how to work. I can write, and I'm going to write my way out of this hole. And so many biographers talk about Fitzgerald's time in Hollywood as a failure, and yet when he's there, he writes almost 20 excellent short stories. He works on something like 10 different scripts, and he starts The Last Tycoon, which, even though it's unfinished, is widely seen as, along with Day of the Locust, as maybe the greatest novel ever written about Hollywood. So he regains himself there just through sheer will and talent and sitting down at his desk and working.
I actually wanted to talk to you about that, of the quality of the writing. And before we get to that, though, the one thing that becomes so obvious, and you write about this, is his determination. I mean, he has this quest, this just unyielding quest that he's going to turn things around, that he knows his duty as a husband and as a father, and he is determined that he is going to start things anew.
Well, we know that Fitzgerald's reputation is as a wild man. We think of him as the partier, the good time guy from the jazz age. But growing up, he had a real sense of responsibilities, what it means to be a man. He wrote a beautiful eulogy for his father, who was an alcoholic and lost the family business and was kind of a disgrace. And yet, Scott talks about him as if he were a great gentleman. He says, everything that I learned about responsibility, I know from my father, which seems terribly ironic, but really isn't there. I think, especially this time in his life, Scott is trying to do better by those closest to him. And these are, you know, Zelda is institutionalized, Scotty, his daughter, is away at boarding school, and yet he's doing it for them. So it's really, you know, he comes through, I think. And, you know, he's been writing since, you know, he was, you know, 18 years old as a professional. And he's never stopped. That's the one skill he has. He can always fall back on it. His fortunes may not be, you know, doing so well right now, but he figures, if I can just keep writing and keep writing and keep writing, something good is going to happen.
How does he enter into the relationship with Sheila Graham, and how does he feel about that? Because she ultimately becomes a bit of a muse.
Love at first sight. He is a terrible, terrible romantic. And in The Last Tycoon, which he subtitles, you know, a romance of the American West, he sees her across a party, and she looks in his eyes somewhat like Zelda did when she was younger. And he kind of just falls into this nostalgia. And he writes about it in The Last Tycoon, where his main character, Star, falls in love with this girl, Kathleen, also British, also younger, also reminding him of his dead wife. And he's just struck by her. He's stunned by her. And later, he's at this ball that is thrown by Dorothy Parker for the Screenwriters Guild. And they talk and they dance, and he's utterly smitten.
And she has a real role in encouraging him to write, and to write The Last Tycoon.
And to sort of regain his love of writing and regain his love of language as well. He ends up teaching her, because she's actually, you know, her real name is Lily Shield. She comes from the East End of London, from the slums. She is not educated. And Fitzgerald, always being a lover of education, takes it upon himself to teach her, you know, all the great English writers and all the great poets that he fell in love with when he was a young man, Keats and Shelley, Byron. And so it reconnects him with that love of language and, again, that romantic sensibility. So she really kind of brings him back to life.
When you immerse yourself in a writer like Fitzgerald, what is the balance of, because this is a very, I mean, obviously this book is in your voice, but by osmosis of being around that writing and having it in your head, having an impact on what you're actually writing.
I'm not using his voice, but I'm trying to work with his sensibility, that idea of how he sees the world, how he apprehends the world. I'm working with his intelligence. I work with his vocabulary a great deal. I work with his hopes and his fears. Who are the people closest to him, and what does he want? How does he want things to be? And get very intimate with him, get very close to him, and thinking about him, you know, day in, day out over 3 years, you know, you get very close, and you hope that that is going to translate into the reader being able to come close to the character.
If you go to the South and you spend a lot of time in the South, invariably you'll start sounding Southern. If you go to London and you spend a lot of time in London, invariably you'll come out with an English accent. So if you spend so much time reading Fitzgerald, do you feel it creeping in every once in a while?
I think so, and especially the comedy, how funny and how cutting and ironic he can be. Those sentences. And that's one talent that I don't really have that sort of, you know, arrow in my quiver. So I kind of pulled that from him. Also, how wonderfully he writes dialogue, you know, the ping pong, irreverent, you know, wacky dialogue he's so good at. So I think a lot of that sort of bled in, because I was reading his stuff over and over, like just cycling through it again and again and again. And it's just marvelous.
Does it make you think of your fate as a novelist, of what can happen, to writers?
Not really, not so much. I mean, I've been incredibly, incredibly lucky. You know, I've been publishing now for over 20 years, and I've always, you know, people have always been very generous. The readers, the critics, you know, the editors I've worked with. So I've never been in that terrible situation where you don't have any prospects. I've always had some sort of glimmer of hope. Plus, I think I came to the realization that this is what I want to do. This is what I've meant to do. And Fitzgerald lamented the fact in a letter to his daughter, and I think it was 1939, he says, you know, after Gatsby, I should have realized that this was my line. I should have stuck to this. I should have cleaved to this and done nothing else. And so coming to writing late, I began writing in my late 20s. I think I'm trying to make up for lost time. And work and work and work and work. There are no sort of, there's no lost years. There's no lost months. Sometimes there's not even the lost days. I'm always just trying to get in there and do it, because it's the greatest job in the world.
You use a Fitzgerald line as an epigraph, which is, there are no second acts in American lives. What does that mean to you when you look at it, and why you wanted to include it?
Scott had this on his mind for a long, long time. Most people think that it comes up in the notes for The Last Tycoon, which is, you know, 38, 39, 40. Mm. But in fact, it comes from an earlier essay, My Lost City, which he wrote in early 1932. I think that when Zelda had her first problems and she was hospitalized and they were broke, he realized that that earlier life that they had was over and that something else had to come next, and he had to figure out what that next thing was. And he was obsessed by this idea of, can we change? As Americans, how can we change? We have all this freedom, but can we really change from the person that we are? So I think he was really thinking about, you know, is it possible? Is there something else after everything has gone wrong? And so he uses that line in The Last Tycoon to talk about his hero, Monroe Starr, who has fallen in love with this girl. One life is over for him, and here's this new life possibly opening. Can he step into it? That's the question. So the question is, can Starr find this new life? And in the book, we're rooting for Starr. I mean, he's our main character. We feel for him. And so we want him to have that second act. And I think, as also as readers, we want Scott to have a second act. And I think he wanted to have a second act as well. And of course, you know, in classical drama, it's not a second act you worry about. It's the fifth act. There's five acts. There's a lot of acts. And I certainly think in my life, I began my professional life as an aerospace engineer. So I'm definitely working on a second, if not a third act at this point. So I think it's true. I think there are second, third, fourth, as many acts as we want.
Realizing this is an impossible question to answer, but I'm curious because I would think you probably thought about it, which is, what if Fitzgerald didn't go to Hollywood?
If Fitzgerald didn't go to Hollywood, he probably would have lived longer, I think. I do think that he kind of worked himself to death. He took those responsibilities very seriously. So he woke up early and he wrote. He went to the studio and he wrote. And he came home and he wrote. And he smoked and he drank. He did not take great care of himself. And he never had, but now it began to pile up sort of on top of his TB and his ill health. I think he would have lived longer and maybe given us more books. He probably wouldn't have gotten out of debt, though. But that would be a different person altogether, I think. This is the third time he goes to Hollywood, not simply the first. So he is drawn there for some reason. And in the late 20s, he said, after Gatsby didn't sell as well as he wanted to, he said, I'm thinking of just throwing all this up and going out to direct in Hollywood.
And as you mentioned, I mean, so many writers are drawn to Hollywood. So many writers went there with this promise. And in some cases, it turned out, and in some cases, it didn't, right?
Well, the writer who goes from being the literary writer of books to a writer of screenplays takes on a whole new position. When you're the writer of the book, you're the last word. Your editor can have some comments on it, but finally you say yes or no, this is how it's going to be. In Hollywood, the writer is the bottom dog. You turn in the script, and what happens to it after that, it's not up to you. And that's a very difficult position for some writers to understand or to accept. And writers like Dorothy Parker, of course, hated Hollywood and yet stayed there because it paid so well. So it's that double-edged sword. Faulkner did it the right way. Faulkner would go out, he'd work for 3 months, get paid a lot of money, go home, and use the money to sort of bankroll his time to write a novel.
There are many, many novelists that I talk to in this program who will take time out of their writing to write the screenplay of the popular novel of which they have written. Have you ever thought of that?
No. I've been offered it a few times for different books. Snow Angels, my first novel, was turned into a movie. And they said, you know, would you like to write the screenplay? And I said no, but you know, on artistic grounds in that, I've already dealt with this material in the best way possible that I could. It would be just going over old ground. It'd be like, you know, plowing old ground I've already plowed through.
So with that said, next project, will you go to more contemporary or will you stay in the past?
I'm staying in the past. The next book is about Jerusalem in 1946. It's about the combined operations of the Jewish underground groups against the British Mandate. So it's looking at political violence and I want to say the legacy of the Second World War as well as, you know, the British occupation of that land.
Stuart Onan's new novel is West of Sunset. It is published by Viking. Stuart, what a delight. Thank you very much for being with us as always. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe, and please give my best to William Kennedy.
I will indeed. Thank you very much. Good to hear your voice again. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.